We are going to talk about summer jobs and allowances and much more during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our regular financial planner, Kevin McKinley, is off this week, but we have a special guest financial expert to answer your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet it at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Happy to have with us once again, Ron Lieber. He is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times. He is the author of The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. And we talked to Ron last year when his book came out. Good morning.
Good morning. It's nice to be back.
Nice to have you back. Well, let's talk about let's talk about allowances first. Many parents like to give their kids a few extra chores around the house during the summer vacation, and according to a 2015 T-Roll price survey, 70% of parents pay their kids an allowance, an idea that you support if it's done correctly. We'll get to that in a second, but first, why is an allowance a good thing for kids to experience?
I like to think about allowance and money in general as a tool for learning, not the primary means by which we conduct commerce, at least in the household capacity, right? So I encourage parents to think about it the same way they might think about art supplies or musical instruments or books. We want kids to get good at money. We want them to practice. And when they have a regular allowance, they have an opportunity to practice.
Yeah. In a piece that you wrote for Slate last year, you said that most parents get allowances wrong. What do you mean?
Well, I think the biggest question that most parents have is whether they ought to expect something, in particular the completion of a regular slate of chores, in exchange for the allowance. And when you look at surveys like the T. Rowe Price surveys and others that have been done over the years, the majority, and quite often the vast majority of parents, require their children to do chores in exchange for allowance. I actually encourage parents to do the opposite. Because we would not take away a child's paintbrushes or books if they did not do their chores, I don't think we should take away their money either, because we want allowance to be that tool for learning. I think the most important reason not to pay for chores is that it actually puts you in a difficult negotiating position, because if you are paying for chores and your kids are good savers, which I assume you want them to be, there will come a point where they say to you, you know what, I have enough money for a while, so I'm not going to do the chores right now. In fact, I'm not going to do them all summer long. And those are the terms of the deal that you set, right? So you're in a real pickle if you set things up that way.
Yeah, I had to do chores and I did not get an allowance. I think I missed out on all this. But if we're not giving...
Well, I'm glad...
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Joe, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I'm not a softie here. I actually think kids should do way more chores than we currently make them do. And they should do them for free, the way that you did, because that's what we do for one another when we live in a household that we want to, function normally, and because we love one another. It's just part of being in the family.
No, that makes sense. But you're saying then if I don't feel like, cleaning the toilet today, that parents shouldn't say, well, then you're not getting your allowance, that you don't want to link the two.
No, I don't think we want kids, considering money as something that sort of hangs over their head or could potentially be punitive. I get that the parents are trying to teach kids how the real world works, but in the real world, unless you're working for a family business, mom and dad are not going to be telling you what to do. And the way the real world works is that you go out and you perform a task in exchange for a wage. And the person who's paying that wage is somebody who is not a blood relation, who is not going to negotiate with you, who is not going to let you off easy if you haven't done things the way that you're supposed to do. So it's not that we don't want kids living in the real world. Absolutely, we want teenagers going out and getting jobs for themselves, or maybe even sooner. But I would just assume kids learn those lessons outside of the home in the real world, and not in some fake real world that parents are trying to construct where they treat the allowance as a wage. Just make them do chores, don't pay them for them, separate allowance from it entirely.
Yeah, so if we're not paying them for the chores, what are we telling them we're giving them the allowance for?
They're getting the allowance because we want them to practice using money and we want them to get good using money. And so, you know, you can set up a three-jar system, right, where they've got some money for spending and they've got some money for saving and they've got some money for giving. And it's not that that money comes with no rules at all. They need to be responsible with it. Presumably in everyone's house, there's some sort of banned item list, things that you're not allowed to spend money on. That list will grow and shrink and change over time. The negotiations around that list are fascinating. We just had an interesting one in my house. So, you know, they have to use the money responsibly. But beyond that, you know, the allowance doesn't come with any sort of strings attached. We just want them using money and thinking about money regularly, making mistakes, getting things right, you know, keeping track of their feelings around how it feels to waste money or spend money or save up for a really important goal or help a cause that's dear to their heart. These are all things that we want them to get good at because the stakes are going to be high the moment that we kick them out, and we want them to make the mistakes early while they're still under our roofs.
And I missed that. Did you say that you had an interesting example in your household of somebody wanting to buy a banned item?
Yeah. So our daughter is 10 years old, and she came to us about 6 months ago and declared that she wanted to dye the tips of her hair purple.
I'm all with it. Never mind. I have purple hair, by the way, but go ahead.
Yeah. So, you know, we have to think about, all right, well, is hair dye for a 10-year-old on the banned item list? You know, it'd probably be on the banned item list for a 5-year-old.
Yeah.
But a 10-year-old, right? And so we also made the decision that, you know what, it's her body. Not dyeing her whole head. It's not permanent, right? A tattoo would be a different conversation at the age of 10. But this was something that she really wanted. It was definitely not something that she needed. If it was something that she needed, we would have paid for it. But because it was something that she wanted and it was not something that we were willing to pay for, she was going to have to pay for it herself. So she made that choice to, you know, take a really big chunk of her savings and some money that she'd gotten at the holidays and for her birthday, and she bought herself the purple tips of her hair. So ultimately, hair dye was not on our banned item list. Now, in other families, it might have been. And in fact, there are kids in her class who are not allowed to dye her hair. But, you know, that was a choice, a close call that my wife and I had to make, and then she went and spent her own money on it.
I think that's a great example, and it really I like how you divide this up, that if it's something she needed, you would have paid for it, but this was just something she wanted, so she then had to make the decision, do I want it that much?
Right, and, you know, I get a lot of questions about, okay, well, what is this allowance money for anyway, particularly the money in the spend jar, which I like to think of as, you know, money for discretionary impulse purchases, and the save jar, bigger purchases that you, you know, crave and covet and you save up for a while, that you set goals for, right? But where exactly do you draw the line between what they spend and what you spend? Well, one simple way to do it is just to think about it in terms of wants and needs. And if you are a family that's lucky enough to be able to afford everything that your kid needs, you buy those things and nothing else. And the deal you make in your household is that, you know, unless it's the holidays or your birthday or some other special occasion, we are not going to buy you anything that you want anymore. And all those wants are going to need to come out of your allowance. And, you know, you set the allowance accordingly, you know, for whatever it is that, you know, things cost in your community. And you say to yourself, okay, well, I'm going to give them just enough money so that they can buy some of the things that they want, but not so much that they don't have to make a lot of really hard choices, trade-offs, right? Because that's what grown-ups do every day, and we are in the grown-up making business here more than anything else as parents.
Yeah. So do we just let, unless it was a potentially banned item, do we just let kids spend their money on what they want to spend their money on and let them make mistakes along the way? Or do you have to approve every single expenditure?
Well, we check in with our daughter to, you know, make sure if it's a matter of first impression, right, an object or experience that we've never considered before, that it doesn't belong on the banned item list. But, you know, other than that, it's up to them. And, you know, in some ways you sort of want to root for things to go wrong once in a while because, I mean, consider this purple hair dye, right? So apparently purple dye doesn't hold quite as well as blonde dye might. And so if this stuff, you know, washes out in the chlorine of the summer, you know, in a matter of 6 or 8 weeks, that will feel like a wasted expense. And that'll be a great lesson to learn. So, you know, we want our kids to learn those lessons. We want them to make mistakes. We want them to feel regret because that's going to give them the kind of pause and discipline they need later on when the stakes are higher.
How do we decide how much to give our kids for allowance?
Well, again, I think the right answer is just enough so that they can get some of the things that they want, but not so much that they don't have to make a lot of really hard choices. And I get that that's vague, but, you know, much is also going to depend on just how far you go with this want-need stuff, right? So, like, at the age of 10, that's about the time when you can say to many kids who are sort of ready developmentally, okay, we're ready to share with you the budgeting responsibility for your annual clothing needs, right? So you sit down with them and you say, okay, you know, here's our budget for underwear, and here's our budget for outerwear, and you do need a new jacket this year, but you don't need more than 4 new pairs of underwear, and socks, and pants, and shirts, and dress-up clothes, and shoes, and athletic gear. And you can set a standard for each and every item. Now, having grown up in Chicago myself, the Lands End catalog came over the transom like clockwork every month. Love talking to those ladies in Wisconsin, the customer service folks on the telephone. And so in our household, we actually have something that we call the Land's End line, where in many categories of spending, what we say to our daughter is, we will pay for the things that you need at whatever price Land's End sets. And if you want something that's more expensive than that, you're going to have to pay the difference between whatever it would have cost at Land's End and the price of the thing that you seek. So where you can go with that, right? Like, let's say you use the Land's End line for every expenditure, right? And you end up with a clothing budget of whatever it is, you know, $300 for the year. You can hand that money over in a lump sum and say to the kid, okay, you're going to manage it. And if you decide not to buy the things that we agreed on at Land's End, you can buy more expensive things or less expensive things and, you know, manage the difference or keep it any way you want. But the rule is that you have to buy everything that you need, right? So if they decide that they want, you know, the Victoria's Secret underwear, if that's not on the banned item list in your house, instead of the Land's End underwear, well, maybe they'll spend more money than that. But they're going to have to get their winter coat at the Goodwill and not at Land's End because they're probably not going to have enough left over.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can raise the stakes in that way, give them ever larger amounts of money to handle and see what they do.
Yeah, you suggested in a piece that that it might be a dollar per year of age, or it might be 50 cents per year of age, or somewhere in that range. It's kind of up to the parents. We have Jerry on Facebook who writes that when he was a kid, we were excited to help with chores for our 25 cents per week allowance. We would buy a comic book and still have 15 cents left for candy or other stuff. I guess that 25 cents went a lot farther than it does today, Ron.
It's true. You know, as my beloved Chicago Cubs continue to tear their way through the baseball season this year, I think often of having grown up 5 blocks from Wrigley Field. It was the first place that I was ever allowed to go by myself. And I would get $5 for an entire day worth of entertainment. And that would get me, you know, a great seat in the right field grandstand and a hot dog and a frosty malt and, you know, maybe a quarter or 50 cents left over. So, you know, for the young kids, right, you start them maybe at 5 or 6 or 7. You know, for those first couple of years, there's not really going to be a ton of stuff that they're going to crave, or many of the things that they will crave are things that you're going to want to put the brakes on, right? There's just only so many Legos you can abide by in your house, or, you know, American Girl doll paraphernalia, right? So a limited budget where, you know, the six-year-old is getting $6 a week is going to keep all of those things in check, and they're going to just have to make very careful choices.
We are talking about whether or not we should give our children an allowance. Our guest says, yeah, we should. And we wonder what you think. Do you give your kids an allowance? How much do you give them? And what is it based on? What questions do you have about setting up an allowance? When we come back, we'll also talk about getting summer jobs, especially college students. Our guest says that college students should have a full-time summer job. Do you? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We will also welcome other personal finance questions. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kevin McKinley is off this week. We are talking with Ron Lieber. He is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times and author of The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. And we are welcoming your questions for him. We're welcoming any experiences you'd like to share. Right now, we're talking about the allowance for children. We'll talk about summer jobs in a moment, but we will also broaden our discussion to other personal finance issues, including paying for a child's musical instrument and much more. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Jill in Kimberly is with us. Hello, Jill.
Hello.
What do you do when it comes to allowance?
Well, I have two kids, 9 and 11, and we've been giving them an allowance for the past several years. And they get their age in dollars twice a month. And we have them divide it between four different categories. We have spend, save, invest, and donate.
Ah.
And we differentiate between the save and invest because saving is like us saving for a vacation. So it's like them saving for, say, an American Girl doll. But invest, we compare to us saving for our retirement way down the road. So if we're like, this is money for college or for a car someday. And in our invest category, we also wanted to teach them about interest. So anytime they have $50 in invest and they give it to us to put into their bank account, then we pay them $5 interest immediately that they can turn around and use however they like.
Well, how about that, Ron?
Love it, love it, love it. There's a bunch of great stuff going on in there. First of all, I'm all for, you know, the fourth jar. And, you know, parents use that invest jar for a couple of different reasons. And in this case, Joy's using them for all of the good reasons. One of them is that some parents want to distinguish between short-term savings for an object or an experience that'll happen in, you know, the next year or two, and long-term savings. So the 12-year-old who is determined to have a vehicle, you know, the moment he or she turns 16, or your family may be a family that is not going to be able to afford to save enough for college just through the effort of the parents or parent, and the kid is going to have to be in on it, right? So it can be helpful to separate between and distinguish between short-term and long-term savings. But the other thing I like about the idea of investing, which I didn't mention here, is that if you are actually investing in stocks as opposed to just putting money away to earn interest, it's a great way to teach kids about risk. We don't have a really great way to teach them about risk using money as children, unless we're allowing them to gamble on card games, which I don't actually think is such a terrible
idea.
Just because it's important for them to learn this. So, you know, I like that aspect of invested as well. And also the matching that they're doing in that household is clever and totally acceptable, right? Because out there in the real world, we are incentivized through the tax system and sometimes through our employers who will match some of our savings if we put money away ourselves. So lots of good stuff happening in that household.
Wait a minute, Ron, I spoke over you. Do you and your 10-year-old play poker for money?
We don't. She's not all that interested in card games, but I struggled as I was writing the book to think about and come up with the best ways to teach kids about risk, because once you're graduate, I mean, really starting like at the age of 22, you need to be putting money away for retirement and for other long-term savings, in part because the sooner you start, the longer that compound interest, the interest growing on interest, has to work its magic. But you also have to be willing to put your money at risk of some losses by investing in stocks. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you probably won't ever save enough to be able to have a long retirement, right? So how are we going to teach kids about what it means to put money at risk? And it turns out that there aren't a lot of great ways to do it. Now, supervised gambling, maybe that's a decent way, right, for kids to, you know, think about odds and experience loss in that context. You know, It's one thing on the list of things that you might try.
No, I think that's interesting because the risk. And then what about the reward that Jill was giving? Here's $5 in interest, you know, automatically for giving us money to invest. How can we reward our kids when they are doing a good job of managing their money?
Well, the way in which you can use matching and vary the ways that you use matching can actually make a big difference here. And sometimes you may set different rules for different kids of different ages with different character traits. You know, some kids in particular have a hard time hanging on to money in the save jar. There's so many things that they want, and they cannot contain themselves. And so maybe you set a matching system that actually varies over time and rewards them as the money in the save jar grows, right? So maybe they get, a $10 match, or they get, a $10 bonus if the money sits in there for 8 weeks, and then a $20 bonus if it's still there after 16 weeks, and a $50 bonus if it's still in there after half of a year. So you can, you know, set up your incentives to match the traits of the child and the traits you're trying to encourage in the child.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Ron Lieber. He is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times and author of The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. He is our guest financial expert for this edition of On Your Money, and we welcome your questions for him, your own experiences, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Barb in Milwaukee is with us next. Hello, Barb.
Good morning.
Morning.
We did the program pretty much the way you were describing. We did not pay for chores. We pay, they did chores because they were a citizen of our household, and everyone did chores.
Mm-hmm.
But they got money because they needed to learn to use it. The one thing that we did a little different than what you're saying is when they were young, starting around 6, they would get their allowance weekly. But then when they got to be 10, they got their allowance monthly. And then when they got to be 14, they got their money every 6 months. And at that point, we opened a checking account so that they could learn to use a checking account and learn how to budget their money over time. And it worked out really well.
Interesting. Why did you do the 6 month period, Barb?
Because I wanted them to have more than just, you know, $10 a week to play with. I wanted them to have a large sum of money that they could see, you know, what the possibilities were for spending large amounts of money and what would happen if you suddenly spent all your money and had none left for 6 months. You know, I wanted them to see how they had to save and how there were goals and also how to use a checking account and, you know, how to be prepared for the future.
Yeah, and did you think are you still doing this, or was this in the past?
It's in the past. My younger son is 23, and actually he just bought a house. So I think that we did pretty good teaching them how to manage their money.
I think so, yeah. Not many 23-year-olds can buy houses. Ron, what do you think of her approach?
My jaw is still on the floor that 23-year-olds are buying houses. I get that prices are lower in the greater Milwaukee area than they are in the greater New York City area, but wow. I mean, that's just amazing. I love the lump sum approach, and here's why. We want to give them ever larger sums of money to manage and with which to make decisions because something really weird happens when they turn 17 or 18. All of a sudden, they're making one of the biggest financial decisions and investments in their entire life, the decision about whether to go to college and where to go to college. And while nobody was paying much attention, we've crossed a point in America where going to the flagship state university for 4 years or 4.5 years or 5 years, if you can't get through that quickly, may well cost you $100,000 all in if you're living on campus and paying all the fees and paying for the books and paying for the transport back home. These kids are making six-figure decisions as teenagers, right? This is bonkers. But we have to, live in the world that we live in, and we have to get them ready for that. And so we want to get them used to thinking about three-figure numbers and four-figure numbers and five-figure numbers, perhaps, when it comes time to think about a car at 15 or 16 or 17, so that they're ready, so that they know what it means to make these big decisions that have a lot of impact. Again, I think it's insane that children are involved in are forced to make these really big decisions at just the point that they're graduating high school, but not at the point where they're fully formed adults. But, it's a system that we have, and the more practice we give them sooner, the more ready they'll feel when they encounter these huge numbers when it's time to go to college.
Thanks, Barb. Next, we go to Bill in Somerset. Hello, Bill.
Hello, how are you doing?
Pretty good. What is your approach?
Well, my parents did this with me, and we did it with our kids. In that when we were growing up, if we'd want something big, they would pay an appropriate part of it relative to our ability to pay what we might save or what we've earned in the mowing the lawn and stuff like that. For instance, our son might want to get a remote-controlled car when he was young, and he could get one for $60 or $70 from the local Target or something. But if we got him paid the extra so that he could get a really good kit from Tower Hobby for $350, he learned how to build it. He could fix it when it broke. We did this with a number of things where we would pay the extra beyond, but they had to put something into it. They had to put some of their own energy into the thing.
Yeah. So parents and kids share for the for that maybe bigger ticket item toy. Ron?
Yep. So what I like about that is that it gets both at value and values, right? Understanding what the difference is between, a $75 car and a $300 car that you build from a kit. That's a question of value, right? How much more joy might you get from the experience of making it yourself, from having something that lasts longer, from having something that feels unique or performs in a different way? That's a value question. But the values question is, what do you have to do to qualify for that $300, to qualify for that help? How long does it take to save? How does that feel? What level of satisfaction do you get out of being able to fix it when it breaks, to put your hands on something and have the skills to do that? That's a values question, even more than it is a value question. And it turns out that every money decision is also a decision about values, because what you spend and on what things says a lot about what you stand for as families. And that's a good example of that.
Thanks, Bill, for the call. Boy, we didn't necessarily intend to spend so much time on allowances, but lots of interest in this area. But we should probably shift gears and talk about summer jobs, as we promoted that we would do that as well. In fact, Bill mentioned how he maybe got some money for mowing the lawn. Maybe he was even mowing the neighbor's lawn. At what age should kids, do you think, get summer jobs?
I think as soon as possible. And, you know, let's keep in mind here, too, that there are all sorts of families out there for whom this is not a choice.
Yeah.
The kids need to contribute to the, you know, everyday monthly budget of the household just to make sure that all of the needs are satisfied. The kids need to have summer jobs because there is no way that the parents are going to be able to save enough for or write a check for Madison, let alone McAllister or Northwestern, right? And so this may be a necessity. But for families who are lucky enough to have a choice, who may be trying to decide between some sort of, you know, enrichment activity for a child versus, you know, making them get a job, I guess I would say this, right? College, as we discussed before, has become so expensive, right? The, you know, the rack rate at Madison may well be $100,000 for 4 or 5 years. McAllister and Northwestern, you're looking at possibly over $250,000. These numbers are insane. And even if you can afford to write a check of that size, or you've saved that much, you've got a grandparent who's going to do it for you, kids should have skin in the game for something this expensive. They should be aware of how much is at stake, and they should be helping. And the best way to help is to earn that money themselves. And it turns out that, you know, for parents who are worried about their kids not, you know, vaulting over the competition yeah. through whatever, you know, summer enrichment activity or competitive internship they might qualify for at the age of 16 or 17, probably shouldn't worry all that much. It turns out that there are not very many college kids or college applicants who, you know, write intelligent application essays about their work experience. And I talked to college admissions officers about this, and, you know, they say they see all these overprogrammed kids and, you know, not that many who are actually doing real hard labor in the summer. So, you know, that can be meaningful, not just for the college application experience, but also meaningful to the child, him or herself, who learns what it means to do something hard and feel the satisfaction of having done that. And, you know, served other people in the process.
So do you recommend that every last dollar, especially a college student might make during the summer, go toward school? Or is there a rule of thumb you have for money?
I mean, you may not have a choice in the matter. Mm-hmm. And or the choice may be, okay, well, for every dollar that doesn't go towards college, that's another dollar that I have to borrow. And if that's the difference between, say, you know, only using federal loans or having to use the more expensive private loans that come from a bank or a credit union or Sallie Mae, you know, that may be the tipping point in that decision, right? I mean, look, you don't want work to feel joyless, and you don't want kids to feel like their entire paycheck is being confiscated. But again, you know, part of the point of the exercise here is to have them contribute. I know a family that was, you know, plenty affluent that said to all four of their kids, you are going to be responsible for the first semester of college tuition yourself. And they said this to them at 13, and every one of them, you know, worked their tails off every single summer after each year of high school. The last one wrote a check to Northwestern University for $22,000. So this can be done. They can be real contributors. And once they are, chances are pretty good that they're going to feel like they want to get their money's worth out of their college experience.
Asman in Rochester, Minnesota emails, our oldest daughter finished her first year of college and has two full-time jobs. She made $22,000 last year. I think students need to work year-round. Do you limit it just to summer or year-round, or what do you say to that, Ron?
Well, I think for families who are lucky enough to have a choice in the matter, in the research on this shows that as long as they are not working more than about 15 hours a week, it does not cause any negative impact on their grades or how much time they can spend on their schoolwork. There are lots of labor economists who have looked at this. So I think up to about 15 hours a week, if they are choosing to work that much, I think that's great work for money. You know, beyond that, you start to run the risk that academic performance may suffer. And again, you know, you're spending all this money for college, you want to have the time to get what you're supposed to get out of it. So again, for families who are lucky enough to have the choice, you know, you might want to cap it at, you know, 15 hours a week during the school year.
When we come back, we'll talk about paying for a child's musical instrument. And since it's summer and lots of travel, maybe we'll talk some about baggage fees and travel expenses. And we welcome your questions for our guest, Ron Lieber. He is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times and author of The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
Take my $5. Take my shirts and collars.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is off this week, but we are very happy to be talking with Ron Lieber. He is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times and author of The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. We've talked about allowances. We've talked about summer jobs. We'll talk about much more. We'll welcome your questions, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Well, as promised, Ron, you wrote a column recently in the New York Times about paying for a child's musical instrument. A lot of kids get an itch to play something at some point, but quickly then get bored with it, and they don't want to play it anymore. When our kids tell us someday they want to play the guitar, for example, how should we respond?
Well, I think it depends on the kid, but also let's start with the parent, this parent in particular, because the moment she expressed interest, I had sort of an explosion of feelings. And, you know, there's always a sort of direct connection between spending money and all of the feelings that we bring to bear on any even remotely large decision. So I wish I had played guitar growing up. Nobody ever put one in my hand. I was a classical pianist. I was and am, you know, a pretty good musician, but never really got my hands on a guitar, always regretted it. And so happy that my daughter expressed interest in, you know, I was ready to slap a credit card down for anything. You know, my first instinct was an expensive guitar. And as I kicked this around on Facebook with some friends of mine, another friend who was a musician came forward and said, wait a second, isn't this the equivalent of like buying all the super fancy ski equipment for the kid who like hasn't even learned yet? So that was the point at which I decided to write about it. And so first of all, you know, keep your emotions in check as a parent. Second of all, think about the kid. Has the kid expressed musical aptitude? Has the kid shown the ability and the willingness to stick to something that he or she is interested in, or does that kid sort of flip first from thing to thing? It's perfectly fine to buy a used instrument or rent an instrument, you know, for 6 or 8 weeks until they get the hang of it to see if it really takes. So, you know, I had to both keep my emotions in check and assess my daughter, you know, to get a sense of what the right decision ultimately was. And we did end up buying her a used version of the starter kind of three-quarter size guitar from a brand called Taylor that does make some very expensive instruments. We ended up spending about $200, however, on her used Taylor.
And did you spend a lot on a really good teacher?
So that is the next question we're going to have to ask. We've managed to successfully procrastinate on that one because it's the end of school. She's going to be away some this summer with relatives and at sleepaway camp. And we want to see kind of what she does with it on her own and, you know, whether she teaches herself stuff from YouTube and, you know, whether it makes sense at that point that, you know, she stopped taking piano and, you know, start taking, you know, the guitar lesson instead. And, you know, do we have the budget for that? You know, it's all wrapped up in a thousand other things. But, you know, there was somebody who suggested to me that the best thing to do is to buy a cheap instrument and an expensive teacher. And that it's hard to argue with that logic. The problem is that we don't know exactly who that teacher is right now. So we're going to have to go find that person.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about the beat up old piano that we had in our house when I was growing up. And I don't remember anybody really knowing how to play it, but I did take lessons and I had the piano in the house. So I was able to do a little bit. And then after about a year or so, I thought I was just far too busy to take those lessons anymore. And my mother reluctantly gave in to my whining, and I stopped taking piano lessons. What can we do to keep our kids interested in the piano or the guitar or anything else as long as possible? Or should we worry about that?
Well, so I was so curious about this that in the Facebook thread that I started on my personal page, a number of people suggested this Taylor instrument, what's called a baby Taylor. And I thought, all right, well, I'm just going to go up the river here and call Taylor and ask them what they think about this. And so the guy who is their master guitar builder there, he said two things to me that I thought were interesting. He said, first of all, he said you should get an electric guitar. Now, Taylor doesn't even make electric guitars for the most part. They're really known for their acoustic instruments. So he's not a very good salesperson. He said you should get an electric guitar because that's the easiest guitar to learn to play for a variety of technical reasons. Now, our daughter was set on an acoustic, so we didn't take his advice on that. But he said the second thing you should do is you should teach them to play their favorite song. That's the first thing you should do once you get the instrument. And that made a lot of sense to me because once they can learn to play their favorite piece of music, there's a pretty good chance that they've sort of caught the bug and that they'll want to teach themselves their second favorite piece of music. And being able to play the things that you love right away is a real incentive to keep going. So we're working in our house on a Taylor Swift song right now, and we'll see what happens after that.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you have a personal finance question for Ron Lieber, who is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times. We have some callers who would still like to talk about allowances, so we'll go to those calls. Ryan in Madison is with us. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. What do you do for allowances?
I was following your discussion for 30 miles on I-50 or 51 North going into Madison, and I just really thoroughly enjoyed this. My wife and I have raised or continuing to raise or rear 6 children, and we have what we call a 50-40-10 split, where we encourage and being parents, we make them put 50% of their money away. 10% obviously goes to contributions to our faith, and 40% they can use to spend as they wish. And sometimes even as parents, that 40% which they choose to spend can be difficult because we don't necessarily, like what they're going to purchase. And so I've had to bite my tongue a lot knowing that if they've been faithful putting 50% away and paying 10% to their religious faith, sometimes we have to just bite our tongue and let them spend what they want to spend. And it's pretty unique to watch 6 kids because they all have different personalities. But we have encouraged our kids to work and put that money away. And it's been wonderful to watch them learn that money is important.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ryan. And we talked a lot about savings and spending and investing, but we didn't talk a lot about giving. Maybe we should talk a little bit about that too, Ron, and Ryan's approach of the 50-40-10 thing.
Sure. So, I make no judgments about what is the right amount. Many families tithe. That sounds like Ryan's family does too. Quite often tithing is, 10% of whatever it is that you have. That's a perfectly great way to, set the split. Maybe your family is wealthy and you've pledged to give away, 50% of your net worth before you die. And so you want your child giving away 50%. That's good too. So, then the question becomes, okay, well, how to kind of get the kids on board and give them ideas about what it is that they should give or to whom? The way that we finally settled on in our household is to make sure that our daughter is aware of her own family's history of having been helped itself. So I was a scholarship kid all through middle school, high school, and college. So we give to the educational institutions that helped me when my family did not have enough. Her grandmother is a 40-year survivor of premenopausal breast cancer. She got that diagnosis back when it was a death sentence, but because she went to Northwestern University in Chicago, or she went to Northwestern Hospital in Chicago, there were people there who had not been as lucky, who had given generously so that my mother could live. And her great-grandparents are Holocaust survivors. And so she understands innately now that, you know, when we see refugees on the front page of the newspaper and on television, she knows what that means because her relatives were refugees too. So she's directly tied into her family history, and we want to make sure that that informs how it is that she understands what her obligations are through the Giving Jar.
Thanks again, Ryan. Next, we go to Judy in New Berlin. Hello, Judy.
Hi. I am the grandmother of my two grandchildren, and my daughter died, so I have them, and I'm the guardian. And so I have given them what they need when they needed it. And so I didn't do an allowance. But now my one is 17, and she was going to get a job, but that means, and she doesn't drive. So that means I have to drive everywhere. So we tried the different places. We didn't find anything, so she's going to help me. I live on a little farm by myself with them, and so she's going to help me clean out the whole basement, which has everyone's things in it, and I have some other outbuildings, and I'm going to pay her minimum wage, and then I think I'm going to do that 50-40-10. That's a wonderful idea, I think. But we do give, and we volunteer our time, and we help others. So they have learned those lessons, but I have a 14-year-old who is he's smart, and he's quite a smart aleck also, and so I have to teach him differently.
Yeah, and Judy, thank you so much. Because we're running short on time, let me get Ron to just talk a little bit about I'm very sorry for your loss. She's taking care of her daughter's children. She's the grandmother, and the 17-year-old in particular would like to get a job, but it's difficult because of no driver's license, and so she's gonna clean the basement. How's that sound, Ron?
It sounds great to me, and here's why, right? On one hand, we don't want to be paying for regular chores around the house, but when there are one-off tasks that are enormous and dirty and difficult, and you know, for which you might well pay someone on the outside to help you out to clean your basement and sort the stuff out and, you know, fix up the outbuildings, then I think it's perfectly fine to pay your child to do that, or your grandchild, just not for the regular everyday chores like taking out the garbage and, you know, keeping the kitchen and their room clean.
Good luck to you, Judy. Thank you for calling. In our last couple of minutes, let's talk a little bit about baggage fees. You wrote about how hard it is to be reimbursed for luggage fees when you don't actually get your luggage in a column. Talk some about that.
Yeah, I was sort of astonished that, you know, and I'm a professional consumer for a living, right? So, you know, I know what I'm doing. I know my way around a complaint form. But I just could not believe that when our bags didn't show up for 30 hours, on a plain old nonstop domestic flight, that it was going to be such a task to try to get the fees back, right? So we paid $25 per bag, $75 total. And for all of you people snickering out there, please keep in mind that, yes, I don't ever check a bag when I'm traveling by myself or with my 10-year-old or with my wife, okay? But we have an infant, and I have a bad back, and that infant comes with a lot of gear, so we just had to check, right? Sometimes you just have to check. And that stuff didn't come for 30 hours. So, you know, I went looking for the money, trying to get it back from Delta. I thought it would be simple. There was this really obnoxious online form where you had to type in all of this information. And then at the end of the day, the only thing they're willing to give you is a voucher to use on their airline.
Oh, thank you.
To be used within a year.
Yeah. And, you know, and I was going to say we have less than 30 seconds. So you're all for a bill that would try to remedy this.
Right. I mean, they should be willing to give you your money back on your credit card the same way you paid for it in the first place, and not a voucher that you're probably going to forget to use.
Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Ron Lieber is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times, author of The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. Thanks to producers Bill Martins and Kai Brito. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.